From Illinois Public Media, this is The 21st Show. I'm Brian Mackey. Since 1971, the country of Syria has been ruled by one family, and brutally so. But that ended this past weekend when rebel and opposition forces captured the capital city of Damascus, prompting second-generation dictator Bashar al-Assad to flee with his family to Moscow.
We begin with breaking news tonight out of Syria, where rebels may be on the verge of toppling President Bashar al-Assad's regime.
And it has been a long time coming. The uprising in Syria started peacefully in March of 2011, nearly 13 years ago. But when the Assad regime brutally cracked down on it, it led to militancy and a civil war that tore up the country.
What's left of Deraya tells of the horrors that unfolded here. Every corner scarred by a ruthless regime's fight for survival. This Damascus suburb rose up peacefully, demanding freedom. More than a decade on, a shattered Deraya and its people are finally free.
From the Umayyad Mosque in central Damascus, this is some 1,300 years of history you're looking at here. The mood is jubilant. Lots of people walking around, happy. The new Syrian flag, there it is in the hands of that little girl. You can also see rebel fighters behind. But every day that passes here, uncertainty is growing.
These events are still unfolding, but to help us think through what we know so far, we are joined by Leila Hussein Mustafa, an associate professor at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign. She's with the Center for South Asian and Middle Eastern Studies at the Illinois Global Institute. Professor Mustafa, welcome to the 21st Show. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you very much, and thank you for inviting me. And I want to add that I'm also work at the library. I'm a librarian of the Middle East and North Africa.
Excellent. Thank you for that. Also with us is Dalal Orfali, a Syrian journalist based in the Chicago suburbs. She's an assistant editor for art and culture at Growing Community Media. Also has a personal podcast in which she interviews high-achieving Syrian women in the U.S. Dalal, thank you for being here as well.
Hello, Brian. Thank you for having me.
And listeners, if you want to join us today, if you have a question about what's happening in Syria, 800-222-9455 is the number, 800-222-9455. All right, Dalal, I want to begin with you. What's your reaction to what's been unfolding in Syria in the last week?
So, Brian, I can take you to my living room that Sunday. It was filled with tender, surreal emotions as opposition forces reached Al-Mawiyin Square. Even now, I feel overwhelmed recalling that moment. My eyes were glued to the TV as the anchor announced that the al-Assad family had fled the country. This family, which had cultivated an untouchable, godlike image in our subconscious and haunted our daily lives, was suddenly gone. I wanted to shed tears of joy. I wanted to jump and holler thousands of miles away from home here in Chicago suburbs. But the fear we endured during their rule still lingered, muting that feeling of victory and almost like not allowing me to fully embrace it. And then as I shifted my eyes to my phone, I was confronted with images of free detainees from Assad prisons in places like Palmyra and Saydnaya. What I saw will stay with me forever. Brian, men emerging in states of shock, women holding toddlers born from repeated assaults and rape, elderly individuals who had disappeared for 40 years without explanation, not mentioning yet thousands of unrecognizable bodies of detainees who died of torture. So also knowing that beneath Damascus, there were underground prisons that no one knew about till now, knowing that this level of cruelty existed, inflicted by one family to an entire population. Like, how could I celebrate? How could I sing or holler, knowing that the pain and suffering that so many had endured? We're living in uncertain times, I can tell you. No one knows what comes next. The transition to democracy will not be easy, and the challenges are immense. But the end of al-Assad's rule marks a necessary first step. It's a moment of hope, tempered by the acknowledgement of deep wounds that still need healing.
Yeah, tens of thousands of people have been disappeared over the generations of this regime. Leila Hussein Mustafa, I want to bring you into the conversation now. Can you put this in a broader historical context and maybe just start with your top line reaction to what's been unfolding?
Okay, I think my colleague said a lot of very sharing joy for what happened. It is a moment that we are waiting for many, many, many years in the Middle East, that this kind of regime can really disappear, getting also persecuted, not just run for, not having refugee in any country. I hope Bashar al-Assad will be coming to the international court. This is really will give people some mercy for their suffering. What happened, it makes me absolutely happy and feeling very happy for my friends and brothers and sisters in Syria. I grew up learning by having teachers from Syria. I'm not a Syrian, but I was educated on the hand of Syrians. They are the most educated people in the Middle East, honestly. And they have a lot of scientists, and they deserve a better life. They deserve all the dignity that they can accomplish. What happened today is actually had been, it had been waited for a long, long time. This is the atrocity of the Bashar and his father, Hafez al-Assad, had been for 70 and more years. 70 and more years, people are suffering. Those who disappear, they didn't just disappear during his son, Bashar al-Assad. It had been really for a long time since Hafez al-Assad, he established all this dictatorship, as it's like a kingdom. The authority went from father to son, and the country is closed. And we all know that the Syrian cannot open their mouths, even in their house. It's a similar regime like Saddam Hussein in Iraq. And I think the happiness that people have it today, they deserve it, and we should really help them, because for 70 years, you don't know what's democracy. You dream of democracy. You dream of being in your home secure. You dream of being educated and not being killed because you don't want to collaborate with a regime. You dream of having your opinion, your voice heard by the regime or by I think the Syrian deserve what they gain today. And we should really celebrate with them. We should support them. And I'm very happy for everyone in the region and the Syrian, of course.
Dalal Orfali, so we've heard comparisons there to Iraq. I've heard comparisons to North Korea. We heard Professor Mustafa say that people weren't even free to speak in their own homes necessarily for fear of being turned over to this family, which not only controlled the government, but also businesses and the security services. You grew up in Syria, Dalal. What was that like?
Yeah, I can totally relate to that. And thank you so much for Dr. Mustafa for, you know, bringing up that that comparison. So I was raised in Syria during Hafez al-Assad's rule. My family's origin traced back to Hama, a city that endured horrific genocide in the 1980s, where I can tell you 40,000 men were killed, including three of my father's cousins. This tragedy left a lasting mark on my family, fostering a deep silent resentment toward al-Assad's regime. During my school years, from elementary school, here I'm talking all the way to high school, we were required to join Tala'i al-Ba'ath and Shabib al-Thawra. These organizations were designed to shape youth minds far too young to understand into unwavering loyalty to Hafez al-Assad, later his son Bashar, and al-Ba'ath party, which, I mean, I assume you're familiar with. They also served as tools for surveillance, ensuring the secret service, or al-mukhabarat, we call them, kept a close watch on every school and family. By 2012, I was in my third year at Damascus University's Faculty of Journalism when the Arab Spring started reaching Syria. I vividly recall a peaceful protest organized by the students in the School of Medicine calling for reforms, and out of nowhere, Brian, out of nowhere, Secret Service agents stormed in, dragging students into their cars. A few months later, my parents made the agonizing decision to send me to the United States after I received threats of arrest before an exam that I had to take. This was a time when thousands of students were being detained, tortured, and disappeared into the dungeons of al-Assad's regime. I personally experienced moments where members of the so-called al-Ba'ath Student Union, this is another surveillance arm, but this time for university students, would try to lure me or others into conversations to gauge their political stance. If you were perceived as opposing al-Assad, they would report you. So a casual comment in the wrong place at the wrong time could have been fatal consequence. After I left Syria, the shadow of fear loomed over my family. My mother was summoned for a secret service branch in Damascus, a place infamous for its walls echoing with the screams of those who entered but never left. Her only crime was standing with students in peaceful protests. I still shudder to think of the possibilities what could have happened that day if one officer had decided that she wouldn't return home. Thankfully, she was released, but the mere thought of her walking into that building still haunting us till this very moment. And when I speak about my experiences, Brian, I know that I'm just one voice among thousands of Syrian students who lived through this nightmare or didn't survive it. And when I recount my mother's story, I think of the countless families that are still clinging to hope, waiting for the knock on their door that would bring their loved ones home. Instead, many receive the unrecognizable tortured remains of their fathers, sons, daughters, or mothers. If they receive anything at all, they are forbidden to cry, forbidden to mourn, and even forbidden to whisper the loved ones' names. We were called rebels and traitors back in 2011, but the truth is far greater than these labels. It was a battle between light against darkness, dignity against tyranny, of humanity against the unspeakable horrors inflicted by a regime that fed on fear.
If you're just joining us, this is the 21st show. We are talking about the Syrian revolution that took place this past weekend with Dalal Orfali, who's an independent Syrian journalist based in the Chicago suburbs, or I should say now is an assistant editor for art and culture at Growing Community Media, an organization there, and also producer of a podcast in which she interviews high-achieving Syrian women in the U.S. Also with us is Leila Hussein Mustafa, an associate professor at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign, librarian in Middle East and North African Studies, and also with the Center for South Asian and Middle Eastern Studies at the Illinois Global Institute. Professor Mustafa, we have seen at least three different countries bombing targets in Syria after Assad, the U.S., Turkey, and Israel. I wonder what you make of these actions in the wake of Assad's departure.
Honestly, I'm very worried because now we are leaving the country without any security. Anyone can enter, the border is open. There is a heading of specific target from many countries getting involved now in Syria. And this is very scary because it just brings Iraq idea to my mind, what happened in Iraq, like suddenly people celebrating the street, happy, and accidentally in one day, a civil war started, other countries trying to get involved in Iraq. And I'm very worried by having this happen now in Syria. And I'm hoping that the international community will really collaborate in protecting the borders, helping the Syrian new leaders to design the new constitution, to build their country and have a peaceful Syrian, and not having Syria as a playground for new terrorist groups. That really, just if you don't have a security, if you don't have armies, if you don't have police with equipment, how can you protect the civilians? How can you protect people? And especially now, also a lot of countries are deciding to bring the refugee back to Syria. This is going to be a mess if we don't really act as an international community, particularly international organization like United Nations, get involved in securing the country from chaos, because if Syria collapsed like Iraq, what happened after the invasion of Iraq, we will have a mess in the Middle East, and it can really move around. And this is not just my opinion, it's the opinion of a lot of political science and people who understand deeply what's happening in the region.
You know, we need to take a break in a couple of minutes. You've mentioned a couple of times what's happened in Iraq. I think many Americans are certainly familiar with the several thousand American soldiers and Marines and airmen who were killed there, but maybe have forgotten, or if they ever really knew the extent of the human toll among Iraqis. Can you just briefly remind us of what unfolded in the years after Saddam Hussein was deposed?
Okay, we saw the same scene happening in Iraq, and I'm talking about Iraq a lot because my work is in preserving cultural heritage in time of foreign conflict, so I have to read a lot of and watch what happening in every country has war in the Middle East. So what happened after the collapse of Saddam, it was also a surprise for people. Nobody believed Saddam would really vanish in one day. So people were celebrating, happy, and suddenly all the regions start getting involved inside. Of course, the coalition forces led by American was all European, and the American army was inside trying to free Iraqi people. But what happened is the terrorists find a way to get in, because it's until today, it's very hard to secure Iraqi borders. And Syria is the same case, actually. The border is huge, so it's very hard to secure the borders as it happened in here in the United States. So what happened, a lot of countries get involved, Iran, the Kurdish also try to get independent. The Turkish are very worried about the independency of the Kurds. Mm-hmm. The Kurds, sorry, it's two words very similar, Turkish and Kurdish.
Yeah. I'm sorry to interrupt. We need to take a break. We're on a fixed clock on our program. I'm very sorry to interrupt you. So we will continue with this story of what unfolded in Iraq and how it may or may not be related to what could happen in Syria. This is the 21st show. Please stay with us. This is the 21st show. I'm Brian Mackey. We are talking about what's happened in Syria in the last week and what it may portend for the U.S. and how Syrian Illinoisans are reacting to the news. My guests for this conversation are Dalal Orfali, a Syrian journalist based in the Chicago suburbs with a growing community media, also has a podcast in which she interviews achieving Syrian women in the United States. Leila Hussein Mustafa is also with us, an associate professor at the University of Illinois, Middle Eastern and North Africa Studies librarian, and affiliated with the Center for South Asian and Middle Eastern Studies at the Illinois Global Institute, 800-222-9455. And Professor Mustafa, before the break, we were talking about Iraq and what unfolded there after the Saddam Hussein regime ended. And I guess the point maybe I should, just to for the sake of time, drive us toward is the civilian death toll. I've seen conflicting estimates anywhere from 100,000 to 1 million people being killed as a result of the civil war that unfolded there.
It's actually maybe more, because to track this was hard. But let me make it shorter also for the audience to understand. Syria has a lot of minorities like Iraq, and this is why I try to keep drawing a comparison between both of them, or similarity, because Iraq minorities were the leaders, or were the regime of Iraq was the Sunni, and a lot of Shia was persecuted, and Kurdish under the Sunni regime. And this is the opposite in Syria. The leaders are Alawi, which is part of the Shia, but they were also the minorities controlling the majority of the group, the Sunni in Syria. But in general, there is a lot of groups, not just Sunni and Shia. There is also different ethnicities in both countries. And this is very scary if you don't have the international communities helping Syria to avoid what happened in Iraq. This is the whole concern that I have.
And Dalal, what are you hearing from friends and family back in Syria about their fears or hopes for the future with regard to that?
Well, yes. Well, first of all, I would like to, relate to Dr. Mustafa's, opinion about the borders. I am worried about securing the northern and southern borders. Like, Turkey and Israel now are using the unstable situation to set a deeper step in Syria, in Syrian land. And I'm against that. And I agree with her that there should be an organized international attention to make sure the situation is not used against the Syrian people's favor. Overall, from what I see from my friends and family on the ground, we don't want to kill the hopes for the future. It is a transitional situation, as Hayat Tahrir al-Sham promised. After all, Syria has a lot of sects, as Dr. Mustafa said, and religion that has to be represented. For me, I want a civil government in which all religions, sects, women and minorities are represented. And here I am talking about everybody, just like Dr. Mustafa mentioned, Sunnis, Shiites, Alawis, Syrian Christians, Druze, women and secular parties as well. Unfortunately, Bashar al-Assad fled the country to Russia, leaving Syria in a state of chaos. And now people on the ground are trying to restart the daily life and keep it up and running. I would want all, my opinion is that I would want all opposition figures outside Syria to come in and join the conversation to shape the vision for a new Syria. I am also worried very much about the detainees' files. From what I'm seeing in videos, there are thousands of families who are looking for their missing family members, and al-Assad's forces did their best in destroying important files on their way out of major notorious prisons. And social media videos are showing many of what's left of these important documents neglected and not properly gathered from these prisons for important future use and prosecutions. Other than that, I heard that there was some sort of there was some lack of movement. Or kind of like, you know, banning of people going out in the streets, that was lifted. I see, civilian initiatives to go out there, start cleaning up, doing any civilian duties that they can do, caring for their neighborhoods, and beautiful initiatives that we're seeing on the ground. They are personal coming out of the people who are living there. But of course, we're looking to see more international attention to keep order in these transitional times.
Professor Mustafa, we've been talking about international attention. There are said to be 900 or so American military personnel still in Syria. They've come under fire in recent months. Russia also has a base there. I wonder what you see as possibilities for the U.S. role in Syria in the coming weeks, months, and years. I should just also add, I saw even this morning reporting, I believe it was in Semaphore, that people who are in the orbit of President-elect Donald Trump have conflicting views. U.S. Senator Rand Paul said the U.S. should get out. U.S. Senator Lindsey Graham wants the U.S. to take a more active role in preventing, as we've talked about, terrorist groups from moving in and setting up shop there. What do you see as possibilities for the U.S.?
This is a very complicated question, and I think the politician can say more, but As a civilian, as an ordinary person from the region, and as someone who really read a lot about the history of this region, you need to make friends with the ordinary people. You need to send them aids from now. People start really suffering from lacking of food. Food prices high. The international community need to get the people of the Syria to their sides in order to secure this country, because if it is collapsed, the 900 American will be more, the 900 soldiers will be more, and I don't think America really need to sacrifice their boys and girls in something can be prevented. Honestly, I don't want to see another 5,000 American died like what happened in Iraq. I want to see no civilian died, no soldiers died, for something can be prevented today if we just collaborate as an international communities, international organizations, including actually universities and education institutes, can help rebuild Syria quickly and fast without getting involved in more conflict, because you can get the Syrian side to you, to your opinion, if you help them to build their life. If you want to lose these people, you just leave them to the mercy of the terrorists and grabbing their land and destroying their country. And I'm very, very also worried about, this is my main issue, is cultural heritage sites. Because if you destroy this, you really frustrate people more than they are frustrated from having their land is grabbed by neighbor countries. Having 900 American soldiers there, the Russians there, the Iranians there, everyone is there. We should really help to clear this land from any foreign soldiers or civilian or not belong to this country, and bring the international organization like United Nations to help rebuild this country.
Dalal Orfali, one of the things we haven't really talked about as much yet is the question of Syrian refugees. I don't know if you consider yourself a refugee, as somebody who left Syria during the last decade, but what do you think should happen? Do you expect people will try to return, or I don't take it where you will?
I am a dual citizen. I am Syrian American, but I can definitely relate to the agonizing feeling of leaving all childhood memories behind. I wanted to add a few points to Dr. Mustafa's situation on the ground. I wanted to say that I'm glad that the Iranian forces are out of Syria. I've been hearing from my friends and family inside about Iran's increasing presence that used to support al-Assad's rule in the last few years, and now that is over. That also led to Hezbollah's collapse, which is another supporter for al-Assad's atrocities to leave the Syrian premises. I wanted just to pick your attention on the enormous Captagon trade, which is hopefully coming to an end. This drug epidemic has affected the Syrian youth, in addition to Saudi Arabia and Jordan, massively, in order for al-Assad's family to fund the lavish lifestyle and build notorious infrastructure. I believe there's a plan for the Middle East, to end all the current set of blood, and therefore opening the door for all refugees to come back home. I see inevitable treaties that will bring everyone to the table and shape a new plan for the Middle East with potential Western grantors. I saw some videos from social media as well. Many of these refugees are, driving their car back from Turkey. And also, I wanted to mention the internal migration. Some of them were displaced inside Syria because, some Syrian territories that belong to the regime, any person from the opposing territories couldn't have been able to enter. And now it's the time, to open Syria again and, have people from Idlib to go back to Idlib, have people from Damascus to come back to Damascus, Damascus suburbs. I am hoping for everyone to return home. Yes. For me personally, I don't know yet how the future will be shaped, but I'm looking forward to the day where I'll be able to help and bring things that I've learned here in the United States, colleges, universities, work experience. I'm hoping that one day I will be able, to help my people in the ways that I'd see possible.
Dalal Orfali and Leila Hussein Mustafa, thank you for being with us to share your expertise and experiences with us. I appreciate it.
Thank you so much for inviting me.
Thank you, Brian, for having us.